Ekatra Podcast Conversations, for the curious, essential knowledge, simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're tackling something really mind-bending, guaranteed to make you think differently about, well, you.
We are. We're diving into the mind's eye, fantasies and reflections on self and soul. It's quite the collection.
Curated by Douglas Hofstadter and Daniel Dennett. And it's not just, you know, dry philosophy.
No, not at all. It really goes after our most fundamental feeling, that sense that there's a single me inside pulling the levers.
Yeah, that little person in the control room.
Exactly. The book basically says maybe that's not how it works at all.
I love the title, The Mind's Eye. It just sets up that internal puzzle right away. Why does this book, which pulls together pieces from, what, decades ago, feel so incredibly relevant now?
Well, because it hits the core questions, right? What is consciousness? What is the self? But it reframes that old mind-body problem for today's world, you know, the age of AI and computation. Ah, okay. So it's asking, if we're basically complex biological machines, what happens when we start building machines that seem just as complex? Is consciousness something special, like a soul? Or is it just information, a pattern?
That's the challenge it throws down. It really forces you to confront those possibilities.
Okay, let's get into the minds behind it. Hofstadter and Dennett, they're quite a pair.
Definitely. It's like this fascinating meeting of different kinds of intellectual energy.
Yeah, how so?
Well, you've got Douglas Hofstadter first, cognitive scientist. Most people know him from Gödel, Escher, Bach.
The Pulitzer winner. Very complex stuff.
Yeah, and his whole approach is about systems, patterns, how things connect. And he's fascinated by these things he calls strange loops.
Strange loops. Okay, break that down for me. What's a strange loop in, like, simple terms?
Think of it like a hierarchy, a system that somehow circles back and refers to itself, like that classic paradox, the statement is false.
Okay, or a snake eating its own tail. Exactly like that. Hofstadter thinks consciousness, that feeling of I, emerges when the brain's complex information patterns sort of fold back on themselves, create self-reference. He's the pattern guy.
Okay, the pattern seeker.
Yeah.
And then there's Dennett. He sounds different, more like the demolition expert.
Huh, maybe a bit. Daniel Dennett, he's a philosopher of mind, very rigorous, analytical. He's a materialist.
Meaning
he thinks everything, including the mind, can ultimately be explained by physical stuff and processes. No room for ghosts in the machine.
Got it.
And he's a big proponent of functionalism, the idea that the mind is defined by what it does, its function, not what it's made of. Brain cells, silicon chips, whatever works.
And he uses these intuition pumps. Sounds slightly aggressive.
Well, they are. They're thought experiments, really sharp ones, designed to push your common sense assumptions until they just, well, break.
Like a lever to pop open flawed thinking.
That's a great way to put it. He wants to expose the shaky foundations of what he calls folk psychology, our everyday intuitive beliefs about the mind.
Okay, so you have Hofstadter looking for the emergent patterns and Dennett trying to dismantle the comforting myths. Seems like they'd clash.
You'd think so, but they actually share this core goal. Showing that the self isn't something fundamental, it emerges from complexity. It's not just there.
Ah.
So they act as these expert guides, curators really, bringing together the science, the AI theory, the philosophy, to help us deconstruct what it even means to be a self.
And the way they built the book reflects that, right? Yeah. It's not a straight argument.
Absolutely not. They call it an intellectual gymnasium. It's an anthology, 27 different pieces.
Wow.
Yeah. Short stories by Borges. You've got essays by Alan Turing, dialogues by John Searle. Each one is picked to kind of destabilize your assumptions about the self.
And they jump in.
Right. After each piece, Hofstadter and Dennett add their own reflections. That's where they guide you, unpack the implications, maybe challenge the piece itself. It's like having them coach you through the workout.
Okay, so that's the structure, this intellectual obstacle course. What's the central message holding it all together?
The core argument is pretty radical, honestly. It's that the self, the I, isn't some single unified thing. Forget dualism mind, separate from body.
Okay, no soul.
Right. Instead, they argue the self is an emergent property, a complex, well, maybe an illusion, or what they sometimes call a useful fiction.
An illusion, but it feels so incredibly real, like the most real thing there is.
Exactly. And they'd say that feeling is real, but the thing it seems to point to, that central self, isn't a physical entity. It's created by the brain's incredibly complex activity. Think of it as a pattern.
A pattern, not a thing.
Mm-hmm. Dennett uses this great analogy, the center of narrative gravity.
Okay.
Like, think of the center of gravity of an object. It's a calculated point, super useful for physics, but it's not a physical part of the object. It's an abstract point.
Ah, I see. So the self is like that, the point around which my life story, my experiences, my thoughts are organized.
Precisely. It's a necessary abstraction, a focal point for the narrative, but it doesn't have substance itself. And the book uses these wild thought experiments to prove it.
Like brain transplants and stuff.
Exactly. Situations where your intuitive sense of where am I or who am I completely falls apart.
So the goal is really to shake up that simple, comfortable idea of the self and replace it with something messier, but maybe more scientifically accurate.
And potentially more wondrous, too. Seeing consciousness as this product of a fantastically complex biological machine.
Okay, let's dive into some of those thought experiments.
Yeah.
How do they start chipping away at this idea of a unified self? Where do they locate it or dislocate it?
Right, so Parda really challenges that feeling of unity. Mm-hmm. It uses pieces like Borges and I, to highlight the split we sometimes feel between our private inner self and our public persona.
The me that I know versus the me that others see. Which one is the real me?
Exactly. It immediately throws that into question. And then it brings up the huge problem of qualia.
Qualia, that's the subjective feeling, right? The what it's like.
Yeah, the redness of red, the bitterness of coffee, the feeling of pain. It's the raw experience itself.
And that leads to Nagel's famous question.
What is it like to be a bat? Even if we knew everything about a bat's brain, every neural connection, every firing pattern.
We still wouldn't know what it feels like subjectively to be that bat. To navigate by sonar.
Precisely. And that gap between objective knowledge and subjective experience is a massive hurdle for purely physical explanations of the mind. The book makes you wrestle with that difficulty.
Okay, so first they introduce the cracks in unity and the mystery of subjective feeling. Then, in part two, comes the big one, Dennett's own intuition pump.
Oh, yeah. This is probably his most famous, where am I? It's designed to pull the rug out from under the idea of a soul tied to a specific location.
So what's the setup?
Dennett spins this story where, for safety reasons during a dangerous mission, his brain, he calls it Yorick, is surgically removed.
Okay, intense.
It's kept alive in a vat, but connected wirelessly back to his body, which he calls Hamlet. So he can still see through his eyes, control his limbs, walk around, but his brain is physically somewhere else.
Whoa. So the question is literally, where is Dennett? Is he where his body is, walking around? Or is he in the vat with Yorick?
That's the core question it forces on you. Your intuition screams one thing, but the logic gets fuzzy fast.
And I bet it gets weirder.
Of course! They create a perfect computer backup of his brain and then install a switch so he can flip control between the original brain, Yorick, and the computer brain.
So is the computer version him too?
Yeah.
When it's controlling the body?
Exactly. Where does the self reside then? The point is, our intuition about a single localized me just can't handle these scenarios. It suggests the self is more about the pattern of information, the connections, the functional processes.
Rather than the physical stuff itself or its location.
Yeah.
Distributed, maybe?
That's the idea it pushes towards. If the self isn't tied to the body or even the original brain, maybe it doesn't matter if the pattern runs on biological wetware or silicon.
Okay, that leads perfectly into the next section, right? Part three. Is the mind just computation? Can consciousness actually be programmed?
Mm-hmm. And that brings in Alan Turing. His famous Turing test basically sidesteps the deep philosophy.
How so?
He just says, look, if you're having conversations, say, via text, and you can't tell if you're talking to a human or a machine.
Then for all practical purposes, the machine is intelligent.
Right. It's an operational definition. Focus on the behavior, the function.
But then comes the big counterpunch. John Searle's Chinese Room. This one always felt really powerful to me, especially thinking about modern AI.
It's a classic thought experiment for sure. Searle asks you to imagine someone inside a room, let's say they only speak English, who has a giant rule book.
Okay.
They get slips of paper with Chinese characters pushed under the door. That's the input. They don't understand Chinese at all. But the rule book tells them, if you see this squiggle, write down that squiggle and pass it back out.
So they're just manipulating symbols according to rules.
Exactly. And let's say the rules are so good that the Chinese characters they pass out, the output, form intelligent sounding answers to questions written on the input slips.
So someone outside the room would think, wow, whoever's in there understands Chinese.
Right. But does the person inside understand a single word of Chinese?
No, clearly not. They're just shuffling symbols.
That's Searle's point. He argues that computers, like the person in the room, are just manipulating syntax symbols according to rules without any real understanding, any semantics or meaning.
That hits hard. Is that what large language models are doing? Just being incredibly sophisticated Chinese rooms?
That's the debate it fuels. And Hofstadter and Dennett's reflection here is key. They push back.
How?
They suggest maybe Searle is looking for understanding in the wrong place. Maybe it's not the person inside who understands. Maybe understanding is a property of the entire system, the person plus the room plus the giant rule book, all working together.
Ah, okay. So understanding isn't in one component, but in the whole interconnected process. That's a different way to frame it.
It shifts the perspective, and this idea of the self being about the system, the process, the ongoing pattern, flows right into part four, which tackles identity over time.
This is where things get really weird with teleporters and copies, right?
Yeah.
Derek Parfit's work.
Exactly. Parfit poses these scenarios. Imagine a teleporter that works by scanning your entire body and brain state, destroying the original.
Yikes.
And then transmitting that information to, say, Mars, where it perfectly reconstructs you atom for atom with all your memories and personality intact.
So is the person on Mars me? Did I survive teleportation, or did I just die and get replaced by a perfect copy?
That's the crux of it.
Ooh.
Or what if the machine malfunctions and creates two perfect copies? Which one is the real you?
My brain hurts just thinking about it.
Parfit's point, and the book really runs with this, is that our notion of a persistent, unchanging self that must survive doesn't hold up. What continues isn't a substance, but a pattern, a psychological continuity.
So the self is more like a story that continues.
Yes. That center of narrative gravity, again, it's the ongoing story, the connections, the psychological flow. Mm. That's what matters for identity, not some underlying soul substance.
Okay, but wait. If everything is just physical processes, patterns, computation, what about free will? Are we just puppets dancing on neurochemical strings?
That's the big question tackled in Part V. And they don't offer an easy escape hatch. They lean towards compatibilism.
Compatibilism. Meaning free will and determinism can somehow coexist. How does that work?
The argument isn't that we can break the laws of physics. It's that freedom doesn't mean escaping causality. Instead, freedom is about acting according to your own concealed reasons, your values, your complex internal state.
Even if that internal state itself is the result of prior causes.
Exactly. Freedom is about self-reflection, about the complexity of the system making the choice, its ability to weigh options based on its internal model of the world. It's acting in accordance with who you are, not being mysteriously uncaused.
So it's a different definition of freedom than the sort of ghost in the machine version.
Very much so. And then in the final part, part six, they do something crucial. They acknowledge the limits.
They don't claim to have solved everything.
No. Especially when it comes to qualia, that subjective, what it's like. Even after breaking down the unified self, that raw feeling of experience remains profoundly mysterious.
The hard problem of consciousness.
Right. And they admit that. The book's aim wasn't necessarily to provide the final answer, but maybe to clear away the philosophical debris so we can start asking better, clearer, more scientifically grounded questions about it.
That makes sense. It's like, let's get rid of the bad ideas first. What an incredible intellectual journey they take you on. Okay, let's try to boil this down. For someone listening, trying to wrap their head around this, what are the main takeaways, the core themes?
Okay, theme one, definitely. The self as a useful fiction or pattern. That feeling of being a single, solid me is incredibly compelling, but it's likely an emergent property, a kind of operating system the brain creates. A strange loop.
And the takeaway for everyday life?
It's actually quite liberating, I think. It means your identity isn't fixed. It's more like a story you're constantly writing and editing. You have more flexibility, more agency in shaping who you are than if you were some unchanging essence.
I like that. Okay, theme two.
Substrate independence. This is the idea that consciousness, intelligence, the self pattern, it's about the function, the process, not necessarily the specific material it runs on.
So biology might be the first substrate, but theoretically?
Theoretically, it could run on silicon or something else entirely if it achieved the right kind of complexity and organization.
Which is why this book feels so urgent now with advanced AI. It forces us to think about the ethical implications. If a pattern can be conscious, what are our responsibilities to non-biological patterns?
Exactly. It sets the conceptual groundwork for those future debates.
Okay, and a third key theme.
Reductionism without nihilism. Just because we can break down consciousness, explain it in terms of physical mechanisms, doesn't mean we diminish it.
Right. Understand how the heart pumps blood doesn't make love less real.
Precisely. Explaining the how doesn't destroy the wonder or the value of the what. You can appreciate the intricate machinery and the richness of the experience. They aren't mutually exclusive.
Those are powerful themes. The book is also packed with lines that just stick with you, like little conceptual tools. Should we share a few?
Absolutely. They're great anchors. Here's one that really gets to the heart of the self idea. The self is not something one finds. It is something one creates.
Oof. That puts the responsibilities squarely on us, doesn't it? It's not about discovering your true self, but actively building it through your choices, your narrative.
Mm-hmm. Active construction versus passive discovery. Okay, here's another, aimed right at the AI discussion. Could a machine think? Could a machine have conscious experiences? These are not empirical questions. They are conceptual ones.
Meaning, we can't just build something and see if it's conscious. We first have to agree on what consciousness is. What are we even looking for? It's a philosophical task before it's an engineering one.
Exactly. Define the target before you shoot. And one more, capturing that nuance about brains and computers. The brain is not a computer, but it is not a computer either.
I love that one. It avoids the simplistic brain is a computer analogy, but also rejects the idea that there's no similarity. It forces you to think about information processing in complex systems, whether wet or dry.
It really captures the complexity. So how do these big, sometimes abstract ideas actually connect to the real world? What are the practical applications?
Well, application one jumps right out, AI development and ethics. This book gives us a much richer, more philosophically grounded way to think about assessing future AI. Are we looking for genuine understanding or just incredibly clever mimicry? The Chinese room question, basically.
And how we answer that has huge implications for how we treat advanced AI, legally and ethically.
Definitely. Application two, personal identity and change. Understanding the self as a narrative, that's potentially transformative for therapy, for personal growth. Well, if you're stuck in a negative self-image or dealing with past trauma, realizing that yourself isn't a fixed thing, but a story you can learn to rewrite. That's incredibly empowering. It's not about changing some unchangeable core, but changing the pattern, the narrative.
That offers a lot of hope. And application three.
Neuroscience and compassion. Thinking about the self as a pattern physically instantiated in the brain helps us understand conditions like dementia, or traumatic brain injury.
Because these conditions literally damage or alter the physical pattern that is the self.
Exactly. It's not just memory loss. It can be a fundamental alteration of the person's identity pattern. Understanding that, I think, fosters deeper empathy and compassion for patients and the families dealing with those heartbreaking changes. It reframes it as a change in the underlying physical system.
That's a really important point. Seeing the mechanism can increase compassion, not decrease it.
So, wrapping this all up, what's the single biggest thing you take away from the mind's eye? What's the lasting insight?
For me, it's that fundamental shift in perspective, moving away from seeing the self as a thing, a soul, an essence, a little person inside, and starting to see it as a process, an incredibly complex, dynamic, self-referential pattern generated by the brain. Once you make that shift, even though mysteries remain, you start asking completely different, hopefully better, questions about who we are. It forces humility, but also deepens the awe.
Yeah, I agree. For me, the lasting value is its power to provoke. It doesn't just give you answers. It fundamentally changes the way you ask the questions about existence, identity, and the future. You can't read this book and think about yourself in quite the same way ever again.
That blend of challenging fiction, hard science, and rigorous philosophy, it leaves you in what they perfectly called a state of enlightened bewilderment.
Couldn't have said it better. A truly essential read. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.